You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Brookings and to what I think will be a fascinating discussion on faith, feminism, and the family, the three F's. So it's easy to remember. I'm Belle Sawhill, and I am a senior fellow here, but I am really representing the Center on Children and Families this morning. My colleague, Richard Reeves, who was involved in this report as a co-author, I can't remember now whether he's in Las Vegas or London or Paris. I only know he was scheduled to be in all three places in a single week. And so my hat is off to him. He does a lot, but he's very interested in these issues as well, as is the other co-director of the Center on Family and Children, Ron Haskins. So my own interest goes back a long way. My very first book was on the family, and I wrote another one a couple of years ago called Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. And so I continue to follow the work of the group that's with us today. I want to say, in the interest of full transparency, that I consider myself a feminist, that I consider myself someone who believes that families, especially married, stable families, have good effects on children. Written a lot about that. And on the faith front, I really believe faith is an important element in many people's lives, although it's not a big element in my own life. I was interested in looking at the data in the report that one of the most common categorizations when you ask people what their religion is was SBNR. And when I first looked at that, I thought, what the hell? I shouldn't use what the hell in this group, right? But what in the world is SBNR? And it's spiritual but no religion. And so that's interesting. Now, the credit for organizing this event goes entirely to my friend Brad Wilcox. He's a towering figure in this field, and I have huge respect for him, even though he and I don't always agree on everything. And I want to thank him and his various collaborators who you're going to be hearing from, including the Family Studies Institute, or Institute for Family Studies, and the Wheatley Institution, and various other partners that they had in their work. As you know, or you will learn, this has been a multi-country study, so the data that they used are very extensive and interesting. So with that, let me invite the first panel to come up here to the stage. The first panel is going to be, come on up, guys. Going to be Lori DeRose. She's in the Department of Sociology at Georgetown. Also, Spencer James, Associate Professor, Department of Family Life, Brigham Young University. And Conrad Hackett, Associate Director of Research, Pew Research Center. And last but not least, Christine Emba, who's a columnist with the Washington Post. So turn it all over to you now. Thanks.
There we go. So the report that I've seen copies of, I hadn't seen hard copy until this morning, that you have is The Ties That Bind, and there are three main chapters. So I'm first going to tell you about the first one, which is faith and fertility in the 21st century. Then Spencer will talk more about relationship quality, and then I'll talk about negative aspects of relationship quality, namely domestic violence and infidelity. But let's start with fertility. Okay, so basically the question in our first chapter is religion still pronatalist? And to some people it might be like, yeah, of course it is. But it's actually an important question when the highly religious United States has reached an all-time low in terms of its total fertility rate. CDC just produced those statistics this week, and that's one of the things that was supposed to be keeping our fertility higher than other developed countries, was that we were a more religious country. And in general, women in more developed countries average 1.6 children. But there's a pronounced fertility fork with countries clustering around 1.9 and around 1.3. It looks like this. If you look back in the 1980s, there's a bunch of countries at all sorts of different levels. But as you go forward in time, there aren't that many in the middle anymore. And the question is, what's different about the countries that have a higher, more sustainable fertility and those countries that are clustering around a lowest low fertility? And what Rinfis, the author who published the piece that I just showed you the graphic from, says that it is generally easier to combine work and motherhood in the countries at the high end of the fertility fork. And they emphasize very much that there's more than one way to do that. Fathers are more involved in the United States than in some other countries. Policy is better in some other countries than the United States. There's more than one way to do it, but essentially that's sort of the key to higher fertility is a compatibility between work and motherhood. And this fits with the rhetoric that says that gender equity is the new natalism, that if you provide for women to be workers and if men are more involved in the family, that's how you're going to get closer to replacement fertility than in a lowest low 1.3 kind of setting. So gender equity is hypothesized to be the new natalism, and the question we asked is whether the new natalism has replaced religion in terms of, can you actually still have religion fostering fertility when it also fosters traditional gender role attitudes? That's at odds with the idea that women can be workers and mothers together. Not completely at odds, but nonetheless, there's a tension. And we ask the question whether it's becoming less relevant for fertility in a world where the persistence of gender, traditional gender roles, is associated with lower fertility. So think Italy, that has a very low fertility. Okay. So this is the first of the graphics from the report that I want to highlight here. And basically, this is just individual level data showing that at the individual level, faith still matters for fertility. Everybody who attends religious services has more kids than those who never or practically never attend. This is data from the sixth wave of the World Values Survey. Also looked over time, and this pattern is more or less the same in all of the last four waves of the World Values Survey. This is the oldest one here, with highest attendance rates at the bottom, going to the light blue of lower attendance rates and lower fertility. And if you skip to the top, you see something very similar. In the middle, it's close to the same pattern, although admittedly not exactly. So basically, religiosity has a very similar relationship with childbearing over time. And then we ask the question, why hasn't it become less relevant? And an important answer is sitting right, whoops, I went the wrong way. No, that's right. It's sitting right in front of you in that frequent religious attendance does, in fact, predicts more traditional gender role attitudes. So the assumption that religious people are more gender traditional is, in fact, right. The next piece of the assumption is that gender traditionalism is an obstacle to fertility, and that's the piece that's wrong. Individuals with progressive gender role ideology actually have fewer children. Now, this doesn't mean that countries with progressive gender role ideology have fewer children and a lower total fertility rate, but individuals do. And we interrogated that a little bit further to say, okay, what's going on there? Why does this individual level result that says traditional folks have more kids essentially contradict the fact that Sweden has more kids than Italy and Spain? And you know, what's going on with the individual level story versus the country level story? And one explanation is marriage. We used an attitudinal item from the World Values Survey, those who agreed that men should be favored when jobs were scarce. The item was, I think it's, do you think that men should be favored
when jobs are scarce. And the people who disagreed are the ones we say have progressive gender role attitudes. And the ones that agree that men should have priority in the job markets when they're tight or that aren't sure, we put them in the more traditional category. Those who agreed with favoring men when jobs were scarce were 23% more likely to be married than those who disagreed. So that traditional gender role attitude was correlating very heavily with marriage. And not surprisingly, married people averaged more than 3/4 of a child, more than their unmarried peers. So this suggests, but doesn't prove, that religion retains its pronatalist influence by being pro-marriage. I say doesn't prove because people tend to bring their kids to church and get married when they have kids. There can be some reverse causation in there where the presence of children is both sparking religion and sparking marriage. So it doesn't necessarily mean that marriage is the driving force, but it's pretty suggestive. I mean, even if the force is going both directions, 3/4 of a child is a big difference. So we think that the reason why more traditional people have more kids is because they're more likely to be married. What about the U.S.? The U.S. is on the higher end of the fertility fork I showed you at the beginning, despite a dearth of policy supporting combining work and motherhood. I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with how paltry U.S. policy is in terms of federal supports for combining work and motherhood. And one of the explanations is that it has a highly religious population, so that's why it ends up on the higher end, even with policy that doesn't help. But again, its fertility's hit a new all-time low. So I'm asking this question again. Has religion become less important for fertility? And this time with a focus on the United States. Religious people in the United States do, in fact, have increasingly distinct fertility in all three of these waves. Why don't I have wave? There's a 2006 wave. Oh, it didn't have children in it. So wave five was missing. No, it can have been children. There was some variable that was missing that I had to leave out wave five. This isn't selective data. But so wave three is at the bottom, 1995 for the U.S., wave six at the top, 2011. And all those places, you see that the never attenders have the lowest fertility, that the infrequent attenders have intermediate fertility, and that the frequent attenders have the highest fertility. What I want you to focus on is the gap. Just because the pattern's the same doesn't mean that the pattern is of the same magnitude. If you look at 2001, and these are children at the time of the survey, so these people who have 1.1 child who are, you know, never go to religious services are going to have more than that lifetime. But, you know, this is cross-sectional at the survey. So they have just over one child where the frequent attenders have in excess of 1.7 children. That is a bigger gap than back in 1995, where it was more like 1.3 versus 1.8. So the gap, fertility is becoming increasingly determined by religion in the U.S. over time, or I should say associated with religion in the U.S. over time. And frequent attenders in the U.S. are, in fact, more gender traditional, just like in the world, frequent attenders are more gender traditional. But in the U.S., there are no differentials by gender role ideology. If you remember when I showed this slide for the whole sample, the agree column was statistically significant in terms of if you agreed that men should be favored when, you know, I think my labels might be wrong here, but it almost doesn't matter because there are no important differences. The reason all those three bars are the same color is because these differences are statistically insignificant, meaning in the U.S. we don't see that traditional folks have more children. We do see in the U.S. less attendance over time, especially if you focus on the green bars. You see a growing proportion of those that never attend religious services. So the retreat from religion is apparent in the U.S. data, at least as measured by attendance. The spiritual but not religious category that Bell mentioned would not be picked up by that particular variable. So back to the question. Gender egalitarianism is supposed to make having children more practical because it saves women from carrying the second shift alone. That's basically the idea about why gender equity should be the new natalism, is that women doing everything doesn't work. That if a woman needs to be a full-time worker and an intensive mother, that she is more likely to opt out than to have two kids, that that's just too heavy a burden. And there's a sociologist that refers to it as a Lysistrata rebellion. I'm just not taking the traditional gender roles, so I'm not going to get married and have kids at all, because the gender bargain is one I do not want. Which, quite frankly, sort of makes sense to me. Even though I love children and I love marriage, the idea of doing it all, I mean, I get tired doing a supported second shift. Imagine an unsupported second shift. The second shift is the work you do at home after you have finished your job at work. My husband and I have joked about, which shift are we on now? Are we both on our third shift? Anyway, the idea that I've just put forward, that gender egalitarianism is the new natalism because the old patterns just simply don't work in women's lives, isn't supported in the individual data from the World Values Survey. Traditional folks are still having more children at the individual level. So the summary for what's going on in the U.S. is that there are bigger differences between the most and the least religious over time, but that the share that's highly religious has retreated. Gender equity is not the new natalism, but neither does a higher fertility of the religious support a higher overall fertility. If you think of it in terms of composition, it's like, yeah, religion's becoming more important in terms of its effect, but it's having an effect on a smaller number of people. So neither of those answers seems supported by the U.S. data. The story across other low fertility countries is a little bit different, not hugely different, but nonetheless, I think there's an important contrast. Religion is linked to traditional gender role attitudes across our multi-country sample, just as it was in the U.S., but it is still pronatalist. Traditional gender role attitudes predict slightly higher fertility, not lower fertility, so that opt-out story isn't an important one in terms of the aggregate picture. And religion is still associated with much higher rates of marriage. And I didn't include this in the presentation, but the influence of marriage is growing over time, too, that the gap in marriage between the least religious and the most religious is growing over time. So the conclusion across the countries that we looked at, all low fertility countries, Europe, in the Americas, East Asia, is that people of faith contribute towards sustainable fertility in modern low fertility societies. Even though I can't say that as strongly for the US, that's still the overall conclusion, that people of faith contribute to sustainable fertility.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Spencer James, and I'm an associate professor at Brigham Young University in the School of Family Life. And I'm going to be presenting to you this morning the second chapter of this report, which we've entitled Faith, Feminism, and Marriage. We're going to talk about institutions, norms, and relationship quality. But I wanted to begin by talking about why we should care about long-term committed relationships. I suspect the fact that you're in this room probably means I don't have to convince you of that. But nonetheless, there are three, among others, really important reasons to worry about this. First is the fact that family change over the last 50 to 70 years has dramatic implications and fuels poverty, insecurity, and inequality. It is not the only thing that fuels those, but it is certainly a key driver of them. And one reason for that is related to number two, which is the fact that committed relationships, most often marriage, are strongly associated with employment patterns, the cessation from criminality, health, and happiness. And finally, a long academic literature shows that children born to and raised by committed, often married parents tend to fare better than children in other various situations. Now, this is, of course, the ideal case. There's plenty of room for wiggle room, and deservedly so, but it is the case that on the population level, marriage and long-term committed relationships like cohabitation very much matter. But of course, it's not just about marital structure, about family structure. The quality of these relationships matter. And as we wrote in the report, to the extent that marriage is able to act as a scaffold for building high-quality relationships, it will remain an important and valued societal institution. But to the degree that it is not, it will decline as a valued societal institution. So the question then becomes, what social institutions do we have, as well as norms, that can help sustain the economic, political, social, etc., conditions where strong and stable relationships can flourish? And the institution that we're focusing on today in this report is religion. Now, despite trends towards secularism that are well established across much of the developed world beginning to happen in the developing world, it is still the case that a majority of couples in the developed and a very large majority of couples in developing countries worldwide report at least some religious activity. And a sizable minority report pretty high levels of religious devotion. And the reason why this matters is the fact that religion and relationships are linked. In a long and enduring academic literature that demonstrates that on average, religious people tend to report higher levels of relationship quality. Certainly there is some selection there, right? There are always selection effects, but there does appear to be a persistent link. But much of this research is focused on the United States, and so we wanted to test whether this link between religion and relationships persists throughout countries in North and South America, Europe, and Australia. Now, related to this, we also wanted to know if this has something to do with the actual effect of religion. Is it about doing religion, or is it merely about being on the same page, in the sense that you may get the exact same benefits if, as a couple, you both are religious or you're both not religious? Is there something about the tension between the two, or is this a true religious effect? To help us answer these questions, we used a new survey that we collected last year. In total, we interviewed 16,474 people across these 11 countries. And again, these countries span North and South America, Europe, and Australia. One quick methodology note is that our sample for the United States is a little bit stronger than for the others, although these are national samples for all of these. Because we focused on couples, we selected out the 9,566 individuals who reported being either married or cohabiting, aged 18 to 50 in heterosexual relationships. And we had about a two-thirds, one-third split married to cohabiting. Now, when it comes to measuring religiosity, we had two pieces of information. The first was how often the respondent attended church. We broke that down by never, at least once a month, and then at least 2 to 3 times per month. And then we also knew whether the respondent's partner, be it a spouse or a cohabiting partner, was more, less, or about the same religiosity as they were. And so we coded this to put people into shared secular couples, less or mixed religious couples, and highly religious couples. So for respondents who never attended church and whose partner was as or less religious than they were put into the shared secular group. In the case of respondents who never attended church but whose partner were more religious, we put these folks in the lesser mixed religious group. For respondents who attended once a month or less, sort of regardless, we put them in the lesser mixed religious group because these are not clearly secular couples, but they're also clearly not both on the highly religious end of the spectrum. And a similar pattern was followed for respondents who attended church at least 2 to 3 times a month. If their partner, was less religious, we put them in the lesser mixed religious category. But for those who attended church 2 to 3 times a month and whose partner was as or perhaps more religious than they were, these were our highly religious couples. In terms of our relationship quality measures, we have three. I'm only going to talk about two today, but I'm certainly happy to talk about that third one. The first is the relationship quality, and this is an index, meaning we are combining four distinct questions on relationship quality, namely satisfaction, emotional closeness, commitment, as well as perceived stability. And then we have sexual satisfaction, where we asked how happy or satisfied these people were with their sexual relationship with their partner. And then finally have joint decision-making, which asked whether major household decisions were made jointly between both members of the couple or whether one or the other makes most major household decisions. So here we have our results. As you can probably tell at this point, there's lots of methodological details that we could, you know, get down and dirty in. I'm happy to do that in the Q&A, but for now I'm mostly, to use perhaps a poor metaphor, this is water skiing, not scuba diving. So I'm just going to kind of roll through. So here we have our main results with the Relationship Quality Index. And we have these sorted out by highly religious couples, less or mixed religious couples, and then the shared secular couples. Note that all of these analyses control for a slew of different variables. But what you see first and foremost here is that the highly religious couples report the highest levels of relationship quality, whether it's for the men there in blue or the women in red, compared to their shared secular or lesser mixed religious counterparts. And these differences are statistically significant for the highly religious. We see a similar pattern in terms of sexual satisfaction. Here what we're doing is we're predicting the probability that somebody said that they agreed that they're satisfied or very satisfied with the sexual relationship that they have with their partner. Again, we have the highly religious reporting the highest levels when compared to their shared secular or lesser mixed religious. Note that in this case, it's actually the highly religious women who are reporting the highest levels, or to be more precise, who have the highest probability of being satisfied. Now, we next sought to nuance this just a little bit because we wondered whether some of this has to do with gender attitudes, that is, gender ideology. And so what we did is we took a question that asked whether they agreed with the statement that it is often better for the man to work outside the home and for the woman to focus more on in-home type of tasks. It's a good but definitely still heteronormative approach to measuring gender ideology. And what we found was interesting. Particularly among the women, we found what we're calling a J-curve. That is, when you sort out gender traditionalists, who reported that, yes, we think it may be better for this sort of specialization approach, compared to the progressives who said, no, it's not always better, or it's not typically better for women to be working in the home and for the man to work outside of it. When we split it out, we find that a large reason why the shared secular couples reported lower relationship quality in those previous slides was largely because the secular couples who hold gender traditional attitudes report pretty low levels of relationship quality. And in this case, the progressives actually pop up a little bit. Now, this isn't a U-curve in the sense that the shared secular gender progressive couples report similar levels of relationship quality than their religious counterparts. It is still, among the women, the case that the highly religious women, particularly the highly religious gender traditional couples, report the highest levels of relationship quality. But nonetheless, the shared seculars report higher levels than those in the lesser mixed religious groups. I then replicated the same analyses for gender ideology and sexual satisfaction. And here we didn't find that same J-curve. Rather, what we once again found was that the highly religious gender traditional women were the most likely, although most of the other categories were not significantly different from each other. So a little bit messier of a finding there. Next, we sought to examine whether this was the case for the United States specifically, because as we saw, this is an 11-country survey. We wanted to know what was happening in the United States itself. And here, once again, we found that same J-curve among the women, wherein the shared secular gender progressive women reported relatively high levels of relationship quality compared to those in the secular traditional group or in the lesser mixed religious group. But once again, with the highly religious reporting the highest levels of relationship quality, especially among the gender traditionalists. So to conclude, what does this mean? Well, first we want to emphasize we cannot address causality. These are cross-sectional data. So we make no claims about causality. We would need to spend a lot more time and, frankly, a few million more dollars before we've got that. But it does appear that religion is consistently linked to better relationships across Europe, North and South America, and Australia. Men and women in highly religious couples enjoy significantly higher levels of relationship quality and sexual satisfaction. Also, women in shared secular progressive relationships enjoy comparatively high levels of relationship quality, while women in the ideological and religious middle report the lowest levels, with highly religious couples, particularly among traditionalist women, reporting the highest levels. So then the question becomes, well, if we're seeing this, what appears to be of a religious bump, the question is, why? How might religion foster better relationships? Well, first, we know that religion fosters norms such as marital permanence, fidelity. It also teaches about love, kindness, patience, the importance of forgiveness, that in principle should lead to better relationships and better outcomes. Second of all, it also fosters or creates, or at least allows access to, an entire community of co-believers that can reinforce these norms. Now, of course, that doesn't always work. Social networks don't always have their intended effects. But on average, we would expect this to be the case. Third, we know that religion encourages shared activities and behaviors, that is, rituals, that endow life with a greater sense of meaning, power, and also a connection to something greater than oneself, which a long line of psychological research has shown to be very important for personal well-being as well as for our relationships. The takeaway point, then, is quite simple. Happy and successful families come in a variety of forms, and religion is one of our key societal institutions can often help us build better and stronger relationships. Thank you very much.
Okay, Spencer, you switched from my slides to yours very easily, but I'm not going back as fluidly.
Let's see, where are we? Is this the one?
Yeah, that's okay. The one. I have to click forward a bunch, but that's, thank you. Okay. I'm sorry. How do I do that? Obviously, I'm not proficient here.
Did the cursor go?
Don't know.
You have a disappearing cursor.
Oh, there we go.
That's on.
No, let's just.
Here.
I had it a second ago.
Nope.
Okay. I can't figure out how it's.
Try resume slideshow.
No, let's just go. This is obnoxious.
No.
Where did it go? Okay. It's down, but then it disappears. If we had that.
The problem is that this isn't hearing this
right anymore.
See, it'll come. Okay, here we go.
Yay!
Okay.
Thank you. So Spencer just talked about positive aspects of relationship quality. It's more depressing to talk about negative relationship behaviors. Intimate partner violence and infidelity are not fun things to talk about. But they're an important thing to consider in the overall picture of how faith, family, and gender ideology interact. So when it comes to religion and negative relationship behaviors, religiously prescribed gender roles could put women at higher risk. This is a very well-publicized idea that religious men may feel entitled to dominate their partners, and less likely but still possible is that they may view their position as household head as license to cheat.
So basically, if you have a doctrine that says that the man's the head of the household, it could have some very negative outcomes associated with it. I am the lead author on this chapter, but I didn't write this sentence, so I'm allowed to say that it's one of my favorite sentences in the whole chapter since I didn't write it. By proof texting, that is, selectively using scripture from, quote, patriarchal passages of their scriptures, religions can provide frames that lead men to see intimate partner violence as divinely sanctioned expression of their patriarchal authority, and women to accept abusive relationships as divinely ordained trials to be endured, rather than problematic situations from which to flee. It's terrible, but we're asking how true is it? Because we want to know how true it is. There's also the possibility that religion is what we call a double-edged sword, that even if it is as bad as that last slide indicates it could be, that that's going to be offset by norms, networks, and nomos of religious communities that encourage positive family functioning. What are those? They're messages and understanding about the importance of good marriages and families, instruction in how to achieve good marriages and stable families, emotional support and accountability. I think that I don't want to gloss over that one too fast. There's a difference between knowing what's right and having someone who knows you know whether you're doing it or not. That embeddedness in community creates accountability. If your prayer partner knows you're beating your wife, there's going to be a lot of pressure on you to change that behavior. And also, marriages can be imbued with spiritual character and significance. There's a psychologist that refers to this as the sanctification of marriage. And again, I don't want to brush over it, because if your family is viewed as part of who you are as a person of faith, it has a different significance than it's just part of who you are as an individual. So all of these positive possibilities can matter more for religious couples than for religious individuals. I assume the logic behind that is fairly transparent, that if you're both embedded in a community that provides accountability, that if you both share the same norms, that whatever positive influences come from norms, networks, and nomos, that they're more enforcing of relationship quality if they are shared. So this brings us to our analytic approach, which is exactly the same as you saw in the last chapter, so I don't have to explain it as thoroughly. We use couple religiosity. So it's not, are you as a man of faith more likely to beat your partner, but are you as someone in a highly religious relationship more likely to beat your partner than someone in a shared secular relationship or in one of those less mixed religious relationships? So we're comparing men and women according to couple spirituality. And we specifically test whether belief in male headship matters. And again, a piece of the chapter 3 that I didn't write that makes it into the slides because I liked it so much. Beliefs are often inferred with, we suspect, a healthy dose of measurement error from measures of religious affiliation. Translated, we assume that if you go to a conservative Presbyterian church that doesn't allow women in the pulpit, you must be one of those patriarchal folks. Or a Catholic church where women aren't allowed in the priesthood, or, you know, fill in your example. The idea is that your affiliation predicts your doctrine with respect to whether the man is the head of the household or not. But we suspected a healthy dose of measurement error on that. So for the Global Family Faith and Gender Survey, what we did was actually ask people, do you believe that the man is head of the household? So first I'm going to show you results without our headship variable, so just across those three categories of couple religiosity, and then I'm going to show you results with the headship variable. So for victimization, I don't even have a graphic because there are no differences among couple types. I could have showed that, but I tried to keep it short and sweet. For perpetration, okay, so victimization is women. Are women in each of those three couple types distinctly different with respect to their chance of being a victim of intimate partner violence? And the answer is no. And with respect to perpetration, the question is are men in each of those three religious couple types more likely to perpetrate intimate partner violence? And again, the answer is no. So completely statistically insignificant there. When it comes to infidelity, and I will actually show you this, but I'll give you the summary before the graph, the infidelity in both shared and secular religious couples, that between those two ends of the spectrum, that it doesn't differ, but that there's more cheating in the middle group. And this is what it looks like. That especially for men, those that are in less or mixed religious relationships. And by the way, most of those are less. 87% of our less and mixed were less, where both partners attend religious services somewhere between once a year and once a month. And only 13% of them are mixed, where one partner has a distinct pattern of attendance from the other. So most of those have the advantage of being on the same page. And we did actually test whether those two were different, and they weren't, which is why we left them rolled together. But in that middle group, the less and mixed religious relationships, the predicted probability of men cheating was 0.18. So men were more likely to cheat, and you see that the shared secular men cheated at half that rate. 0.09 was the predicted probability. So there's a distinct advantage to having a shared secular, shared ethos compared to a middling shared ethos. There's also a distinct advantage to being highly religious. And for the men, there's no difference between the shared secular estimate and the highly religious estimate, but you can see that the point estimate is actually a little bit favors the shared secular men. Don't make anything of that tiny difference, but they're both advantaged. For the women, the shared secular women don't cheat at lower rates than the women in the middle. That 0.11 and 0.10 are not statistically different, but the highly religious women actually do cheat on their partners at a lower level than ones in the middle, but not at a lower level than the shared seculars. So the big contrast that I'm drawing here is with the middle rather than between the ends. Okay. This is where it gets interesting for me. Not that that wasn't interesting, but what about this idea that the doctrine of male headship is the real problem? Let's find out whether it is. So looking at these same three outcomes, first, victimization. Shared secular women who do not view men as household heads are less likely to be victims. That's the only difference. Other than that, we see exactly the same thing. And this is what it looks like. Not exactly the same thing because you don't see – well, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, the same thing because most of these differences are still statistically insignificant. I didn't show you a graph for victimization before because it was boring. I said all three bars are the same height. I'm not even going to show it to you. Now I'm showing you all six bars. They're almost all the same height. The one difference is between the folks in the middle that hold patriarchal attitudes. Yes, the man is the household head. And the folks in shared secular couples that hold egalitarian attitudes. No, the man is not the household head, or I don't agree with the statement that he is. What I think comes out there is that headship does matter, but minimally. It's if you aren't in a religious relationship, your belief can have an influence on the probability of being a victim of intimate partner violence. But it's a little bit surprising that that was the only significant result. Moving on to perpetration. Again, you don't get to see it because it's too boring. Same across all six categories. Before it was the same across all three categories. Without headship, we add headship, it's still the same. Finally, infidelity. There are lower rates of cheating among men in shared secular relationships. You saw that before, but those pertain only among the egalitarians. So headship does matter a little bit. I'll read this last part and then show it to you because it's easier to look at the graphic. And the lower rates of cheating among men and women in highly religious couples become statistically insignificant. So this is what it looks like. You no longer have less cheating among the highly religious when you separate the egalitarians from the patriarchals. I think some of that is just simply sample size because there's still an advantage and they're not that different from each other. I mean, 0.11 and 0.12 and 0.06 and 0.06, those categories aren't very different from each other. On the highly religious end of the spectrum, the gender role ideology doesn't matter that much. Nonetheless, adding the gender role ideology makes the cheating advantage among the highly religious go away. for men, the shared secular men have an advantage over the men in the middle if and only if they are egalitarian. So it's the secular men that do not view themselves as the household heads who have a lower rate of cheating than the folks in the middle. So those that believe more in gender equality in shared secular relationships have an advantage over either the egalitarians or the patriarchal folks in the middle. Okay, so the summary is that the belief in male headship, and these are my words, this isn't in the chapter, is overrated as a risk factor. that when we actually measure that instead of inferring it, we don't see a lot of evidence. It does differentiate shared secular couples, importantly. I thought this was worth noting, is that it didn't differentiate religious couples, but it did differentiate shared secular couples. So if you're in a religious couple, whether you believe the man's the head of the household or not doesn't matter all that much, or doesn't matter at all, for intimate partner violence, perpetration, victimization, or fidelity for men or women. If you are in a shared secular relationship, the advantages associated with that over the folks in the middle are only among the egalitarians. And this should remind you of the J-curve, where you saw that advantage among the shared secular egalitarians, but not so much among the secular traditionalists. So I think this is very consistent with the J-curve. Overall, highly religious couples, shared secular couples, and those in between are all similar in terms of the violence occurring within their intimate partnerships. With respect to the rhetoric that says that religious folks are more at risk, especially because of the doctrine of headship, religious couples experience and commit intimate partner violence just as non-religious couples do. And religious participation in itself does not safeguard against intimate partner violence the way that nomos, norms, networks, rhetoric would say it should safeguard against intimate partner violence. But the other important conclusion is that less and mixed religious couples experience more infidelity than folks at the extremes. So the way that we interpret this, I mean, the question that pops out to me with this set of findings is, why doesn't religiosity protect against these negative relationship outcomes, especially given that you just heard that it promotes relationship quality? If it promotes relationship quality, shouldn't it be associated with less beating and less cheating? And we have two answers to that question. One is that religion is falling short of its potential as a protective factor. There's very little pastoral training in how to deal with intimate partner violence within congregations. Nancy Nason Clark has a network of folks that have researched this, and her stats on, you know, the classes that you get in seminary on intimate partner violence are almost zero in almost all traditions in Canada and the United States. Now, granted, our data covers more than that, but I really don't suspect that Mexican seminaries are a heck of a lot better. So one is that the pastors aren't being trained on how to deal with this very important problem that afflicts religious communities just as it afflicts other communities, and also that there's suffering in silence, that there's some shame in going to your pastor, your potentially ill-equipped pastor, and saying, I need help because my husband's beating me. So the combination of individual-level behavior and institutional-level behavior can be preventing religion from meeting its potential as a protective factor. And so that's part of our explanation. But finally, shared secular, egalitarian, and highly religious couples have important similarities. Now, the word I have up on the slides is homogamy. I actually like Spencer's much better, same page. That being on the same page has its own good effect. I'm discounting that somewhat, though, because a lot of those people in the middle were on the same page, again, 87% of them. So I'm emphasizing the mutual respect part of it. That in a shared secular, egalitarian relationship, as in highly religious relationships, regardless of headship doctrine, there's a lot of shared mutual respect for the other person, as a creation of God, that partner has dignity, and I'm not saying that that's completely absent in the other categories, just that it's less reinforced in the other categories, and that that may be a very important reason why they're different in relationship quality. Okay, so very briefly, is the overall story the same in the U.S.? Victimization, yes. No differences by religious couple type. Perpetration, yes. No differences by religious couple type. Infidelity, women in the U.S. who are highly religious cheat on their partners less than either those in the middle or shared secular women. No differences for men. So the story is a little different for the U.S. because there is a religious advantage, but for the intimate partner violent outcomes, no difference between the U.S. and overall.
Good morning. I'm Conrad Hackett, senior demographer at Pew Research Center, and it's my pleasure this morning to engage with this very interesting report, although I'm going to engage in a narrow part of the richness that's here. The very last thing Lori said in her first presentation is that people of faith can support sustainable fertility levels. And this gets back to some ideas in the first chapter that were fascinating to me, and I want to discuss two questions based on them and then comment on one of the conclusions from the religion and fertility chapter. So my first question is, should replacement level fertility be a goal for society? The fertility chapter takes the normative position that replacement level fertility of 2.1 children per woman on average should indeed be society's goal. The authors describe this with their term sustainable fertility, and I would have liked to know more about this and why they see this as the particular goal that society should strive for. Some people make an economic argument that, in fact, higher fertility is desirable because it could drive economic growth, while others would argue that fertility levels below replacement level fertility are desirable because they will minimize the human impact on our planet. But what is the rationale for replacement level fertility, and why do we call this sustainable? My second question is, if we grant that low fertility that exists in many advanced countries currently is a problem, is religion the answer? According to this the analysis you saw here, fertility levels have been declining over a 20-year period across people of all religious commitment levels, although at any point in time, the more frequently a person attends religious services, the more children they have on average. I'd like to highlight three implications of this pattern. Implication number one, in many advanced economies, even fairly religious young adults may already be on track when they finish their childbearing years to have below replacement fertility. And furthermore, if the highly religious continue to follow the trend of their less religious forebears, then this trajectory of declining fertility over time that the report shows suggests the fertility of the faithful will merely slow down the move below replacement level fertility that is underway rather than having the potential to reverse course. Implication number two, an interesting consequence of these fertility differences, if everyone is having declining fertility but the more religious are having more kids, that means that if everything else were equal over the long term, and if children inherit their parents' religion, then the society would become more religious through fertility. Now, in countries like the United States, we know that something else is going on. People tend to move away from their parents' religion as they age. But however, globally, projections my team at Pew Research Center has done suggest that in the broader world, where we have highly religious countries without the kind of secularization we see in the West, if current patterns continue, then we could have very large fertility differences between the secularizing West and the rapidly growing rest of the world, driving a more religious world overall, even if there's different dynamics in Western countries. Implication number three. if the fertility of the faithful is not the solution for challenges related to low fertility, like the economic burden of supporting aging societies, then it could be that alternate solutions are more feasible, such as welcoming immigrants from countries that still have very high fertility rates. Now, finally, I'd like to turn to the conclusion of this paper, which claims that, quote, across low fertility countries in the Americas, Europe, East Asia, and Oceania, the fertility gap associated with extremes of religiosity increased 15% from 0.24 children to 0.27 children across the last two decades. The report contrasts the average number of children ever born to respondents currently aged 15 to 49 who attend worship services more than once a week versus those who never attend in various waves of the World Values Survey. And the highlighted conclusion suggests that the impact of religion has grown between wave 3 and wave 6 of the report, of the survey, rather. Now, at one point, the authors do acknowledge that this difference is, quote, too small to matter statistically. And I'm inclined to agree, but since the authors nonetheless give prominence to this difference in the conclusion and introduction, I think it's worth considering that if they had instead compared the results from different waves shown in the report, their method of comparison could have led to a different conclusion, that the impact of religion, while persistent, is waning. For example, if they compared the data they report for wave 4 with wave 6, then we would see a shrinking of the gap by 22% from 0.35 children to 0.27 children. I would contend that, in fact, this data is not really adequate to evaluate whether the gap is growing or shrinking. In conclusion, I want to affirm that after the educational attainment of women, religion remains one of the most important factors affecting childbearing. But I think we need a little bit more evidence before we can conclude whether the influence of religion is increasing or decreasing. Going back to the question of whether society should aim for replacement-level fertility, I'm not going to take a position on that, but I would love to know what panelists think and what you all think. And to the question of whether, if low fertility is a problem, can religion be the solution, I must confess that I'm not sure how the fertility of the faithful can be adequate to bring low-fertility countries back up to replacement-level fertility.
Hi, I'm Christine Emba. I'm a columnist at the Washington Post, and I'm going to provide a generational perspective. And since we've had a lot of discussion on the results of the study already, I will try to keep it brief. So I'll admit, first off, that I am a millennial, a part of that much maligned generation. And when we're not busy eating avocado toast and killing paper napkins, diamonds, the restaurant Hooters, we're putting off our relationships, and we're wondering how we could ever afford, or even if we want, children. And yet, we're up. It's our time. My generation is at the end of their 20s and in their 30s. We're in the primary position to be buying houses, marrying, yes, having children, and setting up our adult futures. But we, and women especially I speak of here, worry not just about cost, but about fairness and the toll that relationships and fertility, as we've been calling it, may have on our lives. Will marriage be fair? Who wins and who loses in careers, in leisure time, and in health? And are we sure that we can count on our partners to be real partners? And of course, a side question, do we even have partners? Tinder is not helping us all that much here. Relationships based on or colored by religion, another one of those institutions and norms that we are bent on destroying as a generation, are often viewed with a particular skepticism. We're paranoid, you see. We may have watched our parents break up. We may have watched the economy crumble. And we may have seen many of the same traumas in religion and religious institutions as I think everyone in this room can understand. Yet when we talk about the relationship between, well, relationships and religion, one of the biggest concerns is equity. Which is why, in this study, The Ties That Bind, the distinction between patriarchal and egalitarian couples was so interesting. That said, The Ties That Bind had some counterintuitive takes, at least from my perspective. The first, which we've gone over, and so I'll water ski past it, as Spencer said, was about J-curves. There were a number of different J-curves in this study, and mainly they showed that being unequally yoked, as it was called in my evangelical Wednesday night classes, or marrying a partner of another faith or belief sect, is less than ideal. And this became particularly apparent in discussions of relationship quality. So couples who were the same, aligned in secularism and in their gender ideology, usually progressive, as well as couples who were aligned on the other end, religious and traditional or patriarchal, were the happiest. They won on measures of satisfaction, attachment, commitment, and stability. Of course, for relationship quality, income was the best predictor, but I think we could all expect that. The most intriguing point I found, though, in this study was this line, and I'll actually just read it from the study. Religion may channel gender traditionalism into a family-centered form of living that gives partners clear norms for their relationship and family life, but does so in ways that are interpreted as solidarity-enhancing rather than patriarchal. By contrast, gender traditionalism in more secular or only nominally religious contexts may give men a license to treat their partners in more domineering and less considerate ways. The latter, I think, is what most progressives and progressive millennials fear when it comes to relationships, religion, and both of those combined. However, many of us seem not as clear. We seem not to know that the former may be possible. As the data continues to appear, and as we discuss on this panel, I'm interested in seeing whether our opinions begin to change.
We are a little bit behind on time, but let's take a few questions from the audience. Please state who you are and where you're from. Right here. Do we have? I think we have a microphone coming. Yes, we do.
Thank you very much, Larry Checo, senior advisor to Serve USA. Just a little personal background. I've been married to my wife for 40 years. It's been a great monogamous relationship. I would classify us as SBNRs, I think it is. Okay. But I think you could almost exchange the word religion for economic inequality as well. I think a lot of healthy marriages depend on good incomes. And I think a lot of what's going on today in terms of family breakup is financial stress. And I don't think this report covered that at all. And I think that, that's my question would be, should you have included economics and income into your report? Because I think it would sway things a lot.
I think that's a great question, and before you all answer, I'm going to collect a couple of questions given our time limitations. There were a lot of hands in the back on the aisle there.
Gabriel Greenspan from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So I thought it was interesting examining the idea of mixed couples.
Put the mic closer.
Okay. I thought it was very interesting examining mixed couples. Couples where one of the people's religious and one of the couples is not religious. I was wondering, did you look at couples where both partners are religious, but they're from different faith traditions. One is a devout Christian, one is a devout Jew, for instance, or one is a devout Jew and one is a devout Muslim. You know, you can pick your examples, but what is the effect there if you have two highly religious people from different faith traditions?
Good. The woman right behind, yes.
My name is Anne Solkowski, and I used to live and work in the countries of Niger, Senegal, and Tunisia. So this is a question. I'd like to hear more about Muslim sub-Saharan Africa. I've heard about many other continents.
One more question here.
Actually, I have three quick questions.
Okay.
They're quick. I'm Beverly Sauer. I was formerly tenured at Carnegie Mellon, but I'm now retired and a choir girl. There's the data question. You don't really discriminate about one child versus six in highly religious relationships and how that might skew your data on the number of children. Another one might be, is it the network effect of religion, or are there other networks which might serve the same purpose in a secular couple? And then are there safeguards in religion that enable people to get out in ways that maybe there aren't safeguards where you don't have a network or somebody looking after you?
Okay, thank you. These are great questions. I'm going to turn now to the panel, and I don't think all of you should answer every question, so try to trade off. The first one is about economics. Who wants to take the economics one?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're mic'd, I think, yes.
Yeah. I'm always debating because I teach large classes, so I can't project it necessarily. So the answer is we did take a good, long, hard look at the economics. I didn't have time to sort of drop the graphs, although they are available in the report. And what we found is that what we're calling this religious association is similar in size to our finances variable. Of course, when you're doing a cross-country study, you know, you can't just ask straight up about income because income means different things across contexts. And so we have a variable that asks roughly how comfortable your finances are. Very comfortable, not at all, etc. And when we compared the relative effects of that finance variable to these religious variables, they produced similar effect sizes. Now, I'm 100% with you. If I could change one thing in an instant, I would change people's economic outlooks. I think that's ultimately where the money's at. But that doesn't negate the fact that religion still has this clear and persistent link across countries.
Do you want to get in on this?
So good, I guess.
Christine wants to get in on this one, too.
Yeah, it's where the money's at. So I would hypothesize, and I wonder if you guys can tell me if this seems correct, that religion in relationships that are perhaps financially troubled or less financially secure might still be helpful in keeping parents together because of what you described as nomos and networks. So the idea that there is, you know, a faith or a higher cause or a reason that this relationship exists and that one should protect it, even though there are outside forces, financial forces, putting pressure on it. And also the idea that there could be social networks that would help a financially unstable or troubled family stay intact, whether through church networks, networks of religion online, networks elsewhere, where people can reach out for either material or sort of psychological and philosophical assistance. That is what I've seen in my limited experience. You know, families with children who are undergoing financial instability, you know, reaching out to their churches and asking for donations or seeing if someone can take care of their kids or talk to their husband or wife about what to do or help them find a job, et cetera, et cetera. So I do think that religion can actually have an impact on the economic question. But then I would say, again, with this generational perspective, absolutely yes. And this was one of the questions that I, too, had about the report. I was not a contributor to the report. I'm just commenting on it. I think it's very clear, and the research has long shown, that financial hardship is one of the number one causes of relationship breakup and family breakup and instability. And also, when we're speaking of fertility, especially in my generation and younger generations overall, when you ask why people are not getting married or having children or having as many children as they would like, the number one, two, and three responses in most surveys tend to be about financial hardship of some kind. Either we can't afford a wedding, or we can't afford childcare, or we can't afford to have simply another child, even though we would want one. And so I do think that this economic inequality and economic instability is probably the number one question that we have. But there are many other studies, I think, that do focus on that.
So the question about different faith backgrounds, do you want to take that, Lori, or somebody?
Do you want to? I would be guessing. You've looked at the data more
closely. So we looked at that early on, but we haven't yet had a chance to dig precisely into that different faith couple combination. We did control for different religious affiliations and didn't find a lot of differences, but of course those differences are only across the outcomes rather than looking at differences across the couples. But that's a really interesting question, one that we plan to explore in the upcoming months.
And we'll probably run into sample size problems.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be limited to the larger affiliations, of course. I mean, there's not that many Buddhists, for example, in our study.
If I can interject for a moment here, I think this first question about what are the big drivers, you know, you all wanted to focus on the role of religion and gender ideology, and that's really interesting. But I kept thinking you've got this massive data set. You've got 11 countries. You've got 11 identified religious affiliations. And you did break out the U.S. for some of your analyses. But I kept thinking, what are the big drivers here? Did you ever run an analysis that simply looked for what is the, you know, what are the right-hand variables when you put them all in there that have the biggest effects? Is it economics? Is it something else? Is it what Christine is talking about? Is it education of women, which I would be high on my list, and I think Conrad mentioned? Yeah.
The answer is yes.
okay.
the three biggest in no particular order were education, particularly among women, as you just mentioned, finances. Again, we can't get exactly at income because, you know.
Right.
And then third was religion. In terms of the three variables that seemed to separate out along the relationship quality, sexual satisfaction, joint decision-making variables, those were sort of the three largest differentiators.
Okay. Somebody asked about Muslim countries, I think, and then we had a lot of questions at the end about is there a big distribution of, you know, kids with the highly religious and especially the more traditional couples having lots of kids affecting the analysis? Any comments about those last couple of questions?
I'll take those.
Okay.
We would love to expand the Global Family and Gender Survey to more lower-income countries because the Latin American countries that we included were relatively high-income countries. We don't have Bolivia.
And for the record, I pushed to include Africa here, but I got shot down.
Spencer and I both have an affinity for Africa, as you do. We had a South African potential partner that didn't work out, and we were bummed. Not that South Africa is Nigeria. It'd be interesting to
Niger,
Nigeria, and Senegal. Didn't you mention?
Senegal, Tunisia.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. And then right, but on the Muslim end, to look at Northern Africa as well, or countries in the Middle East. So we would like to have a second round of our survey specifically to pick up lower-income countries and Muslim countries. It's not that there are no other countries we could pick up if we were successful in getting funding for a second round, but those are our two big priorities, is what does this look like in lower-income countries, and what does this look like in Muslim countries? And then I'll answer. I did do average fertility. I'll defend that just by saying that if we're looking at it at a societal level, that's the right measure. I understand that the distributions get skewed by people that have five or six children or seven or eight, but in terms of the aggregate question, I think that the combined measure is the right one.
Okay, I think, go ahead.
Sorry, on the Africa point and Muslims, I just wanted to say that our work at Pew has found, as this report found, that Muslim fertility tends to be higher than for any other group. That's a general pattern that's true in many countries. And in Africa, the high fertility for both Christians and Muslims is profoundly consequential for the future trajectory of the world. And Christians are increasingly more concentrated in Africa because of high fertility, and the high Muslim fertility in Africa and elsewhere is making the world increasingly Muslim.
Yeah. I'm going to make an executive decision that because this was such an interesting panel, and it really was, and you all did a great job, but we did go over our time. So I'm going to suggest if you need a break, just take it informally. And we are going to pull the second panel up right now as soon as we thank this panel. So join me in thanking this one. Thanks. Is Hannah here?
Not Syria, but I was looking for an email from her.
If she's not coming for some reason, we could have Christine up here again. I think she was terrific, or maybe she's left.
Some of the
I think we should start.
Okay.
It's already 10 minutes past the time it was supposed to start.
Well, we can start this session at 10:30.
Oh, okay. I'm off. You're right.
Yeah.
I'm off. You're right.
Should I ask Christine if she wants to come back up?
Excuse me?
I like her.
Hannah's here.
So, yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, we'll wait then.
Okay. Anna? We actually have, she's here. Hannah's here. And we're not scheduled to start until 10:30 for this. Yeah. The bell's fine with 10:30, starting at 10:30. She's here. Yeah, she's just... So. Yeah, there she is. UVA colors there, buddy.
Huh?
I got the UVA colors.
I almost went yellow this morning, so I'm glad I did.
How are you?
Good to see you.
We actually have a, yeah.
Hi.
Carol. Hi. Hi, Anna. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you again.
Very good to see you.
Should we have a mic here for you over here?
Yes.
Yes. That's it? Okay. Thank you. Okay, those in the back, we are about to start, if you wouldn't mind taking your seats.
We're going to go ahead with our second session this morning on the new report, The Ties That Bind. And we're talking in the second session about faith, feminism, and family life. And I am pleased to welcome a distinguished panel to my right here. We have Hannah Rosen from NPR, obviously Belle Sahil from Brookings here. We have Jason Carroll from the Wheatley Institution and BYU. And then I'm from the University of Virginia and the Institute for Family Studies. And I wanted to kind of begin our conversation by touching on one of the themes that was articulated in the first panel. And that was sort of on the trajectory of fertility that we're seeing both in the United States and in much of the developed world towards less fertility, towards lower fertility. In fact, just last week, the CDC announced that we're reaching a new record, or we've reached a new record, of about 1.72 babies per woman on average in our fertility rate here in the United States. And so I wanted to sort of have people just sort of reflect on the way in which both religion and feminism may be kind of affecting our fertility trends here, based both on this new report and other kinds of thoughts that they might have. And of course, one interesting, I think, sort of additional point just to highlight here is that, you know, a number of scholars and public intellectuals have been kind of talking about how feminism is the new natalism, how in some ways surprising we're kind of seeing comparatively high levels of fertility in countries like Sweden, for instance, and that may be because of the way in which they have more generous work-family policies and norms that encourage men to engage in their families. So I just want to begin our discussion by sort of reflecting on the way in which faith and feminism may be affecting fertility, and if indeed, if sort of having a close to replacement fertility is even an ideal for us. So maybe, Belle, do you want to jump in on this question at all with this first
thing? Sure. I guess that I felt like there was a hypothesis in this report that a more egalitarian gender ideology would actually improve.
pro-fertility, and that feminism is pro-natalist. And I think I don't agree with that. I think that feminism is going to reduce fertility for the very simple reason that once women have lots of choices, more of them are going to choose not to marry and choose either to have fewer children or possibly none at all. And when you add in the extra issues of cost and caring for children and so forth that Christine brought up, and all the other things that are driving fertility that Conrad brought up, I think that the whole idea that feminism is pronatalist is just simply wrong. Now, I think that religion is probably slowing down the long-term secular, now used in the trend sense, decline in fertility in more advanced countries. And I think I want to make a more provocative point about that, which is when societies go through very disruptive changes, and we're seeing a lot of that now for economic reasons, for demographic reasons, and for other reasons, that's not good for society if the change is too rapid. And, you know, this big populist wave that we're seeing now may be in part related to that. So at the same time that there are certain forces that are requiring these adjustments and leading to lower fertility, maybe we do need some traditional institutions to both slow the process down a bit and also provide safe harbors for the people caught up in all of the disruptive change.
Any thoughts on this question?
Yeah, I'm so glad Bell said that. That's an interesting frame. I was thinking more broadly about religion because you had asked, was I surprised by the finding that essentially, I mean, if we do take for a minute the idea that feminism is natalist or that there are places like Sweden where sort of a more pro-feminist ideology has led people to have more children, I wasn't surprised that women in religious marriages were happier or were having more children. That part wasn't surprising to me. I think when I look at America, what is more surprising to me is that religion hasn't been able to stem the tide of non-marriage more than it has. Like, that seems to be the more forceful thing. Like, if you're talking to a woman who's already in a religious marriage, it's not surprising that she's happy because her entire world is kind of, you know, reinforcing the choices and decisions she's made. And if you've ever seen a video in a Mormon temple or if you've ever listened to James Dobson, like, the of sort of getting religious men to be active participating husbands has been going on for 40 years now. So I think that's sort of well accepted. But that more broadly, I mean, if you look at divorce rates and single mother rates, they are prevalent in places where people call themselves evangelicals or where people define themselves as religious in some way. So that's what's to me more broadly surprising. Is how little effect religion has had in America on the broader trends.
So there's a kind of a story that the report kind of lays out in terms of like the difference between kind of being nominally religious and being sort of more seriously religious. And in that sense, we do see across a number of the outcomes in the report, like relationship quality, for instance, that the nominally religious folks, to kind of pick up on your point, Hannah, are more likely to be doing worse off in their relationships compared to those couples who are shared in their religious practice and their faith. And that speaks in some ways to the sort of the broader ecological point that you're touching on too, and that is that in some of our more religious states, like, you know, Arkansas, for instance, or Oklahoma, you see, you know, more divorce than you would in much of the U.S. But in states that are more consistently religious, like Utah, for instance, you see some of the more, you know, more family stability there. So there's a big distinction in the report at the individual level between those couples who are sort of shared in their faith and those couples who've got either a mixed background or who are more nominally religious.
Is there any other state but Utah? Because Utah's unusual because the Mormon Church is so excellent at emphasizing both the role of the father and the role of family. I mean, the message is so consistent that it seems exceptional.
Well, we do see actually at the county level a sort of a more consistent relationship between being more conservative, and I'll take that here as maybe a proxy for religiosity, and more intact families. So that in the states are, you know, often quite heterogeneous in some ways when it comes to sort of what's happening at the state level. But when you actually look at a more fine-grained level, we do see that more sort of conservative counties have both more marriage but also more family stability compared to less conservative counties. And then, of course, at the individual level, we're seeing in this report that couples who share a strong faith tend to be have higher quality relationships, and other work suggests that they also are more stable. So, for instance, there's new research showing that people who are regular religious practice or engaged in regular religious practice are about 40% less likely to get divorced. So, but the nominally religious folks are often doing the worst. That kind of speaks to your...
The what? The middle. The nominally
in the middle
religious.
Sort of, yeah, category.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? I was reading it and I was thinking, well, why frame the questions this way? Like, what are you trying to get us to think about? Are you trying to get us to think about ways in which kind of the left and we call it the left and the right, but the religious and the secular have like overlapping interests, or sort of what is the or is the idea? Because I felt like I was trying to read between the lines in the message of this report. Is it like, you know, we can't force people to be more religious? Like, that feels like that's not a government policy that we can have, is everybody has to attend church every week. What's the message we're thinking about when we learn that, you know, people at the the U-curve or whatever, people at the extremes have the most stable and the happiest?
Let me respond quickly, and then I'll let Jason respond too, to sort of give his take on this. I think, you know, part of the thinking here, on my part at least, is that I think we live obviously in a very pluralistic milieu today, and one that is in some ways increasingly pluralistic and, of course, increasingly polarized. And so I think part of the idea here is to sort of to honestly think about ways in which, despite the sort of polarization that exists in our country, in our society, you know, are there points of common ground, in this case, in family life? And I think one of the sort of interesting pieces here is that it looks like, you know, despite the fact that sort of feminists and at least more conservative religious people often have serious differences, I think that one thing that they tend to share is an expectation, you know, a code that sort of men are supposed to be engaged pretty seriously in the life of family. And I think that's sort of a piece of common ground that's not necessarily recognized and could be more appreciated. So that's, I think, one response that I would offer to you. The second response is to think, too, about, and we can do this maybe a little bit later on in the panel, is sort of, are there points of common ground on, say, family policy that we could identify that might be fruitful for, you know, future work on when it comes to sort of strengthening families in the U.S. And I've got some ideas about that we can touch on later.
I think one of the things that's easy to do, and it always happens with a report when you're trying to condense and get key ideas, is that a lot of this starts to sound categorical when we actually might have, in many cases, differences by degree. Or we might emphasize and talk about what might be called the secular progressive, and then we have this kind of traditional religious. We also had progressive religious, right? And we had a traditional secular as well. And so I think those differences of degree start to become interesting contrasts as well. One of the things I thought for myself that ties into some of this is we paid attention to Pew and others that have also been emphasizing the range and difference of degree that we see around desired work patterns, often for women and mothers during, particularly with children in the home. And so then this issue of choice and this issue of being able to enact and follow a pattern that someone may choose for family life, or particularly for raising of children, there definitely seems to be, and perhaps in the highly religious in many ways, a child up, so to speak, mindset of how that's being chosen and decided on. Around that. And so there may be even in some cases a sense that then the sense of choice, the sense of pattern that is available or the options that may be there with being at home full-time for a season or part-time employment or full-time employment. We see a range across that. And I think without getting into those realities, it's very hard to know what people would be saying they are satisfied with, that they're striving for. So I think we might, you know, and we can talk more about it, I think we might have different pathways to sense of partnership and to sense of commonality. And one may be through a bit more of a sameness or a equality, so to speak, pattern. The other, though, may very well be a partnership through complementarity and equity. And if there's a sense of desire and there's a sense of equal kind of commonality towards it, we see these paths moving people towards a sense of feeling valued, a sense of team and partnership that really does let these different pathways lead to common symbols of value and unity and partnership, even though they may seem to start at different places. And I think that's where the relationship quality and fertility elements of that start to get embedded in those nuances that are always very difficult to capture in kind of the quick cuts that a report ends up doing.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking, like, well, you're probably right that, say, like, Sweden and kind of traditional religious people in America might come up with the same, you know, Sweden says you're home for a year after you give birth to a child. So there are commonalities there. But then if you move one step further, I think the sort of major difference, or has been traditionally in America, is the family question. Like, when you emphasize the family question, what happens is that there's resistance to universal child care. There's this idea that it has to happen in a particular way. And I think it's actually, as Sweden, women stay home for a year has been damaging for women in the workplace. So it's this idea that it can't be done by the government. It kind of has to be done by extra government institutions. That's traditionally how conservative religion in America has viewed child care, and so then you get stuck, you know.
You say you get stuck. You mean in what sense? How do you get stuck?
To me, the answer is obvious. Like, there's been economic shifts in which women are in the workplace. They've been happening for a long time, and no allowance for childcare. And so it's just obvious what's happening in America. Like, we just haven't. It's an economic problem. It's not a spiritual problem. It's not a cultural problem. It's an economic structural problem. And it's not going to be like when you say that women want to stay home. Well, men should be able to stay home for a year. Like, if we struck, it's it, like, the trends are obvious to me. The trends are towards women working more. The trends are towards more equality. There are exceptions to those trends, but those are the trends. And those are the trends in many, many countries in the world. And so the answer is structural. And there's resistance to that in the U.S., and I don't know why.
Well, you know, just building on that, because I really agree with the first part of it, we know, we have great research on this, actually, that the United States is way behind other advanced countries in terms of making work and family values consistent. And, you know, we are not only the only advanced country, but almost the only country in the world that doesn't provide paid leave when a baby is born. And if you are a woman in a managerial or professional position, your employer probably allows you to take it and even keeps your salary going. But if you're a low-wage woman, you don't, and you are just no place. I mean, it's rather shocking to me. And childcare is obviously another example of this, and flexible work hours and so forth, and not saying to a low-wage worker in the service or retail sector, oh, well, you know, you showed up for work, but we don't have any work for you right now. I mean, it's even being told in advance about whether or not you are going to be expected to work that day. And forgetting about whether you might need to arrange childcare. So there are all those policy issues. And just again, to make this a little bit fun and provocative, I wonder to what extent the fact that America is more religiously oriented and religiously conservative than some of those European countries is making it harder for us to adopt these policies that would enable people to combine work with raising children. So I would suggest to the religious community, especially some parts of it, sure, in America, I noticed, by the way, that the largest religious group in your sample was Catholics. And, you know, we are going to have now a huge debate about abortion and birth control, which makes it even more difficult for women to manage getting educated, making a living, and raising a family, because they're going to have more trouble, you know, planning all of that. So I said something positive about religion being an important institution in terms of these major disruptive changes we're having, but it politically might not be such a positive influence. And that's not to take away from its very positive effect, I think, that you identify in your report in terms of personal relationships.
I think on the issue of paid parental leave, I think there is, you know, a good deal of openness on the part of many religious institutions towards moving forward on that particular issue. I think that's a point where we could find some common ground, perhaps. Other areas, you know, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I want to just also sort of ask you, Hannah. I mean, I think it's true that there's been a lot of change both in Europe and the United States. But if you actually look at a more granular level at women's sort of preferences when it comes to how they combine work and family, what you see not just in the U.S., but even in Europe and obviously a place like the Netherlands, is there's a lot of interest in the part, particularly of women, in working part-time or in some cases even being at home full-time when their kids are younger.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it seems to me like the public conversation about kind of work and family in the U.S. is sort of often predicated on this idea that we should be moving towards kind of a model where women are working full-time on a pretty consistent basis across the life course. But when you actually sort of are surveying ordinary women in places like the Netherlands or the United States, you actually see a lot of heterogeneity in their attitudes about sort of the best arrangement. And I think we could do better to sort of acknowledge that and also from policy perspective kind of create a space where if you want to be at home part-time, great. If you want to work full-time, great. Or if you want to be at home full-time, great. And that the policy should not be putting, you know, a premium on one way to address these work and family challenges.
For sure. First of all, the Netherlands is an exception. I mean, I love that study in the Netherlands. Two, I don't think anybody should be working full time. I think my broad objection to these conversations is that I for the life of me, in my soul, do not understand why this is a question for women. Men have children and women have children. This is a conversation for families. This is not a thing where, what do women want to choose or how do women want to work? It's like, how do we want to raise our families? How does a father want to raise our families? The father should not be working full-time when they have children, obsessively, and the mother should not be working full-time. Children need to spend time with their families. Families need to be together. It is not the mother's responsibility to, in my mind, even one iota more than it's the father's responsibility. So I don't think of it as like, how can the father help? I think of it as like, the baby is half the father's and half the mother's, and this is a family, and everybody figure it out so the children are happy and everybody's happy. That is honestly how I think about these questions, you know? So we're always asking women, like, what do you want to do? What's your work-life balance? When do you want to have maternity leave? It's like, she's not the only one who had the baby, so ask everyone in the family what they want to do.
Well, you know, the New York Times did do that a number of years ago, and they found that, you know, there was a desire on the part of, I think Pew has done this, comes something similar, but there's a desire on the part of both fathers and mothers to spend more time with their kids.
Yes.
But there is also kind of a difference, you know, in how moms and dads think about this sort of, you know, this work family juggle. And so on average, moms are more likely to prefer, actually the part-time was their preferred model, here in America, and dads are more likely to prefer the full-time option. So I think we have to recognize that, yes, kids belong to both mothers and fathers, and they both have responsibilities. And obviously one of the points in the report is to sort of stress how that plays out in both secular and religious contexts. But there are also some differences in terms of what ordinary people prefer that I think we should acknowledge.
Totally. And I bet if you asked my question, you'd get different answers from men and women. But ask it to everybody.
So, Brad, I want to ask the following question in that context, which is, do you believe these differences that you've sometimes cited between men and women in terms of their preferences?
Right.
How much are they biological and how much are they cultural? Because
Ooh,
I'm sorry, but we have to confront.
That's a hard one.
We have to confront it. Uh-huh. And I do believe you wrote a book or edited a book about this.
Right.
And We may not know the answer. I certainly don't pretend to know the answer right now. I would only point out that data that show right now or 10 years ago or whenever that women have preferences that are different than men, well, you know, duh, you know, that's because they've been socialized differently.
I think what we're capturing here is what I meant by this idea of partnership through sameness or similarity and partnership through complementarity, right? And with the progressive ideology, right, there's a sense that that needs to be confronted, that needs to be changed, right? Where I think we see from patterns, and I think many from religious tradition are bringing with it a different set of meaning, perhaps, or the way that they're viewing purposes and fundamental identity. And so I think that the ideals, right, the one data point that I've got to jump in here that we didn't cover in the first session was the shared decision making, which the central storyline was across all the groups, similarly high shared decision making, right? So in the highly religious traditional couples, right, the women are reporting same levels of shared decision making in important household decisions, right? So I think when there's a process equality, right, there is at least those who have that view of family life that they're much more comfortable with a complementarity model that might say we're both equally engaged, we're both equally contributing, but it isn't necessarily in a sense of sameness, right? Now, of course, for others, that's not their relationship regime, right? And there's that pattern of saying, oh, that, you know, my partnership pattern is a sameness, so to speak. But that notion seems to be prevalent. We see it in many of our higher fertility families, that complementarity model seems to work and to fit for them. So the question is there space for that? Is there continued space?
There should be. Right. I think neither Hannah nor I are
I agree.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, and the notion, too, and that's where I think that notion about choice, if there's a sense of feeling that that might be a more supported choice, inside of a religious community or context, if that's the view. So, yeah, I think that's where those things do. But when it comes to policy issues, then it starts to feel like, well, wait a minute, if we're trying to move towards these kind of progressive sameness policies, mm-hmm. does this hold us back from that, right? And others may feel, wait a minute, we're prioritizing policies that are about childcare outside of the home. Are we doing the same for that when that's a family's making sacrifices inside the home? I think becomes a major part of that.
Now, you're obviously posing a big question, both, you know, Hannah and Bella, about sort of culture and biology when it comes to gender. And that's obviously a hot-button issue, a hot-button question. But I think, I mean, the sort of the science on this is still, I think, in some ways, you know, embryonic. But we do actually have, I think, research that suggests that they're part of the story here is biological, you know, and, you know, a large part, of course, is cultural. But it's also interesting, too, is there's evidence that suggests there's considerable heterogeneity or there are considerable differences within the sexes, right? So that there are some women who are more oriented towards sort of work and, you know, a professional life, and some women who are oriented more towards the family and domesticity. The same is true for men, but, you know, in different shares. And my view here is, if we kind of continue to do the research on this question, that we'll see that part of this difference, not just between women and men, but within women and within sort of among men, is related to not just sort of cultural patterns, socialization patterns, but also to biological differences as well. And so there's a study, for instance, looking at, you know, differences, you know, in utero, you know, for kids and how those are connected across the life course to differences in behaviors and orientations. So I think, to be kind of fair to the admittedly kind of beginning research in this area, we need to sort of recognize that there's probably a place for this, you know, both when it comes to sort of acknowledging the role of culture and the role of biology, but again, to sort of also recognize it's not just about men versus women, it's about how some women are different than some women and some men from other men as well.
You know, going back to the hours of work issue, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago citing John Maynard Keynes, who back in 1930 wrote an essay addressed to his grandchildren and told them that by now we would all be working 15 hours a week. Why? Because productivity would have grown so much that we could afford to.
Sure.
So I actually checked the numbers to see if we had grown as much as he expected us to, and we had. And where he was totally wrong is how we used our affluence. Instead of using it to buy more time to spend with family or to do other things, he was very into Aristotelian notions of, you know, cultivating the arts and so forth and the mind. But another use of time would be family time. And we completely missed the boat. And in fact, the standard work week in the United States, after having plummeted during the late 19th and early 20th century, has been stuck at where it is, 40 hours a week, since the 1930s. And so I wrote this piece and said, why don't we think about reducing the standard work week to 35 hours? That doesn't sound so radical. Oh, my God. Anyway, end of story.
Well, I mean, the research I find most, for me, what's between the lines in all of this is, it's not exactly about family, because there are also Scandinavian countries where sort of traditional family has decreased, but people still live together and raise children together. It has to do with isolation and connection. To me, that's the most sort of shocking trend that's happening, and I think the most interesting research to me is connected to time and kind of how badly we are managing our time and our free time and conceiving of our time and using our time in a way which is, the trend is away from, and I'm not just talking about kids and their smartphones, like the way technology has increased work hours and not decreased work hours and sort of made us generally less human, and how the effect that has on family and people's sense of isolation and connection, whether they're married or not. Like,
yeah, I agree. So one other question that I wanted to touch on before me opening up to the group here is, we've obviously even touched on already some serious points of disagreement between more religiously conservative folks and more progressive feminist-leaning folks, but are there kind of points of common ground that we could identify when it comes to either sort of a cultural agenda or a policy agenda? And I think certainly, just touching on your point, Hanna, there's a concern that I've been having is just sort of figuring out ways to sort of limit the sort of power and character of the rise of sort of the screen culture in ways that may be affecting dating, marriage, and family life as perhaps like one point of common ground. But are there other points of common ground that we could think of that might be there for us to identify and to make use of? Or Jason, do you have a thought on that question?
I really liked Lori's comments from the first panel about the commonality of the dignity of the person and the respect and the value. I think these domains of family life and relationships become deeply, deeply symbolic, and we're looking for the symbols. The symbols aren't exactly the same in every relationship, but they become deeply symbolic of what means I'm valued, what means that I'm heard, what means that I have a complete stake, so to speak, in marriage and family life and relationships. And I think there's commonality in there. I think the voice of feminism and gender equality has been powerful in that call of making sure that voices are heard and that choices are there and that there's that dignity and importance of that. And I think in the right dose. I think there's an important part of this report that shows that religion's effects, there's a dosage effect. If it's the nominal, there's not much impact, right? If it's at the attendance level, I think there's a higher dosage. I think when you add that to home personal worship and home practices, you have even more of a dosage effect. And in those proper patterns, I think that message is very similar about the dignity of the person and the value and the respect that should be there. And so I think they come from, again, what I think can be pitted as false opposites. You know, there's probably some folks, and if you're in the room, go ahead, raise your hand, you know, when we get to question and answer. There's a lot of folks saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm in that progressive religious category, right? And these are blending and mixing. That shared decision-making variable I mentioned shows that there's a lot of people having this sense of, equality in decision making, even those in our traditional category. So I think they're informing one another and having a common message there that I would hope for a rising generation of millennials would also be really valuable in a sense of that's how you're going to have relationship quality. It has to start with that sense of peer inequality and teamwork, right? Not something that's going to ever happen from a hierarchy or a distinction in those ways.
I'm going to say something that may sound like it's at odds with what I said earlier, but I mean, I do think, first of all, I can't disagree in any way with, you know, there are lots of different ways to live your life, and there are lots of different types of marriages, and we should respect all of them. I don't think any of us is saying, you know, we need to move away from that. But I also think that on the progressive side of many of the arguments in this space, there is too much emphasis on individualism and too little acknowledgement that social norms and social institutions do provide scaffolding, as you, the verb you use in your report, which I think is a good verb, for people's lives. And that without such scaffolding, whatever that scaffolding may be, it can be religion for some people, it could be some other kind of institution for someone else, those institutions are important, and we have moved in a direction in this country and many other Western countries towards so celebrating individual differences that we have paid too little attention, especially for children, I would say. You know, like in the K through 12 years, you can't teach values. And so if you're growing up in a family or a neighborhood where there aren't strong institutions, whether religious or otherwise, where are you going to get your values and your sense of support from? I think you need more than reading and arithmetic to navigate today's world. So religion, I think, can play a role there.
I liked your point. I had never thought of it, and I thought it was really interesting, the connection, this idea that both from traditional religious and progressive, there has been a cultural permission to kind of let men to sort of include in the definition of manhood emotional connection to your family, not sort of just like role, like your role as the provider, but just like a more connected emotional pose towards the family. And I think that is, I'd never thought of that, but I think that is absolutely a commonality on both sides.
So why don't we open up the floor to questions from the audience, and we can kind of continue the conversation. Is there a mic here? Well.
Hello, back there. No?
Okay. She's like, I got it.
I agree 100% with you saying that perhaps we need more.
Just put it closer.
Okay, there we go. Margaret Cope, I'm retired military, but also work on gender gap issues, national service, and national security reform. I appreciate your comments with regard to connectedness and community, the value of that extended family. But another aspect is following up on your religion, because the religions have a broad spectrum. When you say Catholic, it goes from progressive to completely conservative, and so does Judaism, Muslim. And so when you say religion, there's a spectrum there for all of those. Maybe further definition with regard to that would be good. Also, the age of the study, 15 to 49, during that period, women go through a biological clock issue. And how does that impact the study?
Well, there's obviously a lot of
there are a lot of differences between religious traditions and among religious traditions. We're trying to kind of keep that relatively simple in the report by focusing on religious couples who kind of are more culturally conservative versus those who are more culturally progressive. And we do see that, you know, in the main, couples who share a faith tend to do better in a lot of the outcomes, but not all. And there are, you know, depending upon the outcome, those who lean a little bit right are more likely to be, you know, doing better. There's not a, in some ways, it looks like sort of the power of religion is, or the role of religion is more central than their cultural attitudes. Now, in terms of the second question, there isn't really, I mean, we're just trying to sort of focus in this particular report on women who are, you know, in their prime childbearing years or child-rearing years as well, but we don't kind of do much with sort of, you know, differences among that particular age group in this
right.
report.
Well, yeah. But when you reach like 40, that's kind of
staying in. So, I mean, that age group is not so much in the childbearing.
Right, they're more in the childbearing stage, yeah.
One of the, it's simple at the broad level of that. I mean, we did try to, we controlled in all the analyses for children in the home or out of the home, knowing that that could be a little bit different. I love what you're saying. I think there's a whole, there's so much that gets left on the editing room floor, right, as we all know with pulling together a report. I love what you're capturing there. I think it gets back a little bit into that dosage notion I was talking about earlier. And I think we will be looking at some further analyses of not only the amount of religiosity, right? We have a sidebar in the report that looks specifically at home religious practice. I think that's another indicator of orthodoxy or the degree to which people are trying to live faith-centered lives. But then to couple that together with what you're saying, that kind of ideological spectrum, and like I said, we've got this group. We see them right there. They're progressive, highly religious couples, all right? And so I think being able to get into some of that nuance, we start to see a distinction between attendance, between those with attendance, but also with home religious practice, and then together with kind of the branches. But I will say this, the patterns were remarkably similar across all 11 countries and across a wider range of faith groups. So we do in the relationship quality chapter at least show a little bit in one of our tables. We broke out the quality index by religious affiliation, and the patterns are remarkably common across faith groups. Not saying that it couldn't be more that was there. The great comment from earlier about mixed faith couples and relationships, but we did see that. So it was across all the countries, it was across the faith groups by and large, and it was stronger for women than it was for men. So I think those deeper dives are definitely calling to get into some of what you're suggesting.
Val, I'd like to use one of the comments you made to challenge your skepticism that feminism can be the new natalism. I loved what you said about there's too much emphasis on individualism because the social norms and the institutions provide a scaffolding. And if we look at the macro level instead of at the micro level, we find that countries that are more gender progressive actually do have higher fertility than the ones with more traditional gender roles. And I think it might be that expanding of choice. Your assumption was that the expanding of choice would lead more women to opt out and to not do the marriage, childbearing, and home part of women's lives if they had the choice, that feminism would lead to less kids. And what I'm challenging it with is the idea that if either social institutions encouraged men's participation or even just made the burden on women as mothers less intense, or that religious institutions helped support the involvement of men in family life, that choice doesn't necessarily have to lead to opt-out. And I think that's what we're saying is we might see a higher fertility either because of more gender egalitarianism, or to say it differently, but perhaps more accurately,
in more gender egalitarian societies, you can see both gender egalitarianism and religion having a more pronatalist effect, that with choice you would expect both of those things to shine out in terms of fertility differences. And I actually do have some macro level work that shows that that middle group does worse at the macro level too, that nominally religious countries have lower fertility than either highly religious or highly secular.
This gets very complicated, and if I'm understanding your pushback, which I appreciate, I don't think I'm saying that a more gender egalitarian culture, which allows women more supports when they are doing both things, doesn't help. It definitely does. I'm making, it's an interaction effect, if you will. I'm saying that at the first level, before you get to interactions, that long term, I don't expect women having more choices and more equality with men is going to lead to higher fertility. So it's a simpler point, and it's a very long-term point, and it's abstracting from, you know, policy regimes and religious dictates that might be asking dads to do more or whatever. Those things are, to me, second-order drivers, not first-order drivers. Does that make sense?
Conrad?
The big question in the report is religion a force for good or ill in society? And you show in the first chapter that the share of people across world value surveys countries who attend services regularly is pretty stable. The people who are attending infrequently is actually declining a lot. More people never attend. Since you show on a lot of outcomes, things are better if you are a couple who both never attend than if you're sort of nominally attending. Is it your contention then that the rise of people who never attend is good for society or better than having more people continue to be nominal attenders?
Good question.
Go ahead. Or do you want to?
That's good. I keep thinking about the editing room floor and all the stuff that's still laying on the ground. One of the things that I think would be interesting for further analysis is, again, for simplicity and to not have graphs that have got, you know, 20 groups compared to 20 groups, we've got the low religious and the mixed religious together in these graphs. And I think we need a little bit of caution around that. When we look at them separated, right, the mixed religious groups are a bit lower, which isn't a surprise, right? We've got basic same page, I think, is what we came to, right? The same page notion, if they're not on the same page. So that's in there kind of mixed and pulling that down, right? So it'd be interesting to see a little bit. I think our less religious don't quite get pulled down as much as these other groups that are tied together. The other part becomes really around people's, again, back to these symbols and sense of meaning and sense of purpose around this. I think it's easy at broad levels and in a multi-country report to start to look at it quite demographically speaking. But I think another deeper dive of where we're headed in some future analysis is also our data on life meaning and our data on life satisfaction and these kind of patterns as well. The sneak peek is that I think some of that would contend a little bit. I think people having those meaning structures, I love these comments about community and connection around that. I think it's possible across the spectrum, but we still need to see how that is done when we've had some of these traditional social structures that have provided that.
I mean, what's, like, to me, this report's startling, alarming, maybe really good, I don't know, is that it's like the polls
people are happy at the extremes. People seem to be doing better at the extremes, whatever the extreme are. What the extremes have in common, when you're asking what are the points of commonality, the points of commonality is that they're extremes. And so it's just, I don't know how to think about that. Like, I like to think that polarization is bad. I like to think that people kind of believing the things that they believe, you know, just kind of unquestioningly, well, not necessarily unquestioningly, but without giving much space to sort of gray area vagueness is not where I want us to land. But this report is suggesting, and it sounds like your meeting report, that actually people are happier that way.
You know, I didn't interpret it as extremes as much as, and I think Lori or somebody talked about this earlier, is that it's shared values. Mm-hmm. You can have shared values around being aggressive, very committed religiously and practicing that intensively, your dosage point, or you can be very secular and egalitarian and have shared values around that. And it would seem to me, I'm not an expert on, you know, marriage counseling and all that sort of thing, but that one of the sort of common sense views, which is probably right, is that it's a lot easier to maintain a marriage or any kind of relationship if you have shared values.
Shared vision.
A shared vision. And I do want to go back to Conrad's point about, is fertility, is below replacement fertility a bad thing or a good thing? I have really worried about the whole conversation around that. And I don't think that it's as big a worry as some other people do if we have below replacement fertility. The positive aspects of it is that we've got 7 billion people in the world and increasing, and they all want to come to the advanced countries. And it seems to me, with appropriate safeguards, they should be welcomed. So I don't get this point about, you know, we need to worry about declining fertility in advanced nations.
Thank you for saying that. I'm so confused by that. It seems obviously that replacement fertility is a disaster for the world right now and creates short-term issues, but long-term disasters. Like, I don't know, maybe that's not true.
Yeah, no,
when I read all this, I thought, why do we want replacement fertility? Like, the world can't handle it right now.
No, environmentally, you know, there's a whole argument there. And then finally, and I see a lot of people want to get in and maybe take issue with this. I think that, you know, we should worry less about the number of children we have and what we invest in each one. And with limited time and limited resources, and this is what the millennials are choosing, right? If you're going to have children, don't have too many and don't have them too soon, because if you really want to invest in them and you really care about them, you do want to invest in them, you want to invest your time and you want to invest your resources. So you can have, you know, more successful children or children with brighter futures.
Well, I guess in terms of kind of why would we be concerned about low fertility, I think that there are a couple things one could say. One is that just looking at it kind of from women's perspective, with the work of Lyman Stone at Family Studies suggests that there are a large minority of women in the U.S., for instance, who are not having as many kids as they would like to have. And that number actually now is larger the number of women in the United States who reported they've had more kids than they would have liked to have had. So I think there, because fertility is falling now so comparatively low in the U.S., and because women are postponing having kids for a variety of reasons, we're in a situation that's, I think, newer than it was, say, back in, you know, 1965, for instance. And that's one thing that I would say. The second thing is it's pretty clear that sort of economic dynamism is connected to sort of population growth. And we know that, for instance, entrepreneurs are more likely to come from sort of the younger adult band of the population. So there could, I think, be some important economic implications of this pattern, particularly if it keeps going farther and farther down, like we have seen play out in a country like Japan, for instance. And then I think thirdly, there's just a question about whether or not, you know, siblings, cousins, you know, matter for us, matter for our kids. And, you know, it kind of depends on the outcome you want to pick. So if you want to pick education, I think Bell's perspective wins the day.
It's clearly the case that kids in smaller families tend to do better on the education front. But if you want to pick, you know, socialization, or if you want to pick family stability, for instance, I think my perspective is more persuasive. So we know, for instance, that kids who come from large families are more likely to have stable marriages. I think maybe the sort of the difficulties of navigating toys and activities and parental attention makes them perhaps better suited for the challenges of being in a marriage longer term. So it depends on kind of things you highlighted, but in terms of how you think about
strengths. If we're looking at connection issues.
Yeah, connection issues too. So having kin can be helpful.
A kin network of its own.
Yeah, yeah.
A bunch of hands.
I'm going to start with Christine and then move back.
Hi, I'm Christine. I was on the previous panel. A quick point and then a question. I was reading some research regarding the effects of both genders having parental leave, and it seems that the results from Spain have come out recently. They instituted parental leave for fathers as well as mothers, and one of the most noticeable impacts was that once fathers had parental leave, they realized that they wanted fewer children. Presumably, having stayed at home with their wives and with their children, they realized that taking care of children is tough. Perhaps I don't need seven of them. While women's preferences actually stayed the same. So, well, they
increased
yeah. apparently, maybe because they finally had help. So I think that touches on a number of different issues that you've just talked about. But one of my questions is about this traditional versus progressive relationships, whether religious or secular. I think this result was surprising to me and will be to other readers, that often traditional patriarchal relationships tend to be stable and tend to have high relationship quality. And you mentioned on this panel the impact of, yes, a headship dialogue, but one that also involves fathers being present, involved in their children's lives. And I wonder if you would say that that's an understanding of patriarchy and headship that has emerged more recently, or if this has been the case throughout time and we're only sort of coming to realize it publicly now.
An initial thought, at least drawing from the report, it's a great, there's a lot of places it can go. That's where I think that shared decision-making piece. We really thought in many ways that that would be the distinguisher that would trend in the direction of the shared secular couples, right? So we wanted to pay attention to that. When we see that, right, so our highly religious traditionals, women, reporting the same level of shared decision-making. Now, the other thing that we didn't get to is people always ask, so if they didn't say, right, we're about in the 60, 70, you know, level of predicted probability of it being the decisions are made together, you say, well, then what's the alternative for the other 30%? The most dominant pattern is that people, both men and women, say, I make the decisions, right? It's not a gendered pattern where it's traditionally pointing at the husband or father or man makes the decisions. Either we make them together or I make them. Both men and women report that, right, in some interesting ways.
But you know, I just, because this keeps coming up, do we have any idea what shared decision making means to people? Does it mean where we're going to live, or does it mean whether we're going to have chicken or steak for dinner?
The question is framed, and all survey questions, right, can be looked at. Important family decisions. Major. Is it major? Major family decisions.
All right, major helps. Chicken and steak is not major.
I got it,
major.
Right. Yeah. Wheat bread or white bread, right? So I love the question, though, because, again, I think it gets back to getting some false dichotomies here, right, and that it's not happening by degree, right, it's just a type, that of what is this sense of equality, and is it even possible to have complementarity and at the same time have equality, right? Do you have to have a sameness basis so that you can have that? I think there is such thing for couples, right, that I would say is a bit of a process equality. And it is in that decision-making. It is in that sense that I chart the direction and we have that sense of partnership of how that occurs. That's my sense. I think it needs deeper investigation of what is happening in the modern complementarity of many of these highly religious couples' relationships. And these women are satisfied. They're reporting this high emotional connection. We haven't even talked about the sexual satisfaction one that they just
trend away from the rest of the groups. I'm interested by that because I think these are individuals that are deeply impacted by this sense of equality, this sense of value, this sense of symbolism around that. And they're saying, I'm finding that in this type of relationship. If the assumption is that it has to be a shared or similar background for that to occur, that, like you said, it becomes nonsensical. How can that possibly be? I don't think it's a situation of being satisfied with hierarchy. I think it is a pattern of there being a complementarity, but still a sense of deep partnership and how that's being expressed in the relationship.
It might be defined roles. Like, there are studies on gay couples which show the exact same result, which is that gay couples which divide so that in this study I'm thinking of, it was gay male couples where one person in the couple does the child rearing and taking care of the home, the other person is working out. Like, the roles are pretty clearly defined, so they're not negotiating everything, are more happy and satisfied. So it might be that that's just a more frictionless way to operate, whether you're, you know, whatever kind of marriage.
If they're valued, right? They need to feel that it's valued by their partner, feel that it's something that's important to both of them.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I've seen that research on same-sex couples as well, and I found it fascinating because it shows exactly what Hannah just said, and it does support your point. The problem becomes when the division is gendered. Now, you know, I'll just tell you that in my own marriage, I did not like to cook. My husband knew that I didn't like to cook. But I did the cooking because I'm a woman of my generation, and because he knew I didn't like to cook, I can't tell you what positive reinforcement I got from him. I could put the worst meal you ever ate in your life on the table, and he would tell me it was fantastic. And it's because he understood, because he was very smart, that if I was going to keep cooking, he was going to have to give me more than the normal amount of reinforcement to get me to do it. And I tell that jokingly, but I think, you know, more seriously, there has been a pressure on women to do certain things.
I think that's your question, though, because I think one important, I can't really speak to sort of the historical, you know, because I don't have data on that, but I think one interesting way in which I think contemporary religiously conservative couples and families and men have been affected by feminism is that there is, I think, a new expectation, you know, for kind of the kind of process and equity that you were just talking about, Jason, that is a kind of post-second wave, you know, revolution thing. And so kind of in a weird way, I think that part of what's happening here is that more religious family men in America today are kind of have been, and their wives have been affected by this sort of these set of new norms, and they're responding to them in part with, I think, a more engaged approach to the family because they do value the family and the marriage so much. So there's a way in which kind of feminism has had a pretty profound impact even on religious communities that we're now, I think, seeing manifested in sort of this approach on the part of religious men to, you know, being more practically engaged with their kids. So, and the woman just next to you.
Hi, Mary Budars. I'm retired. I'm just, when you're talking about the difference between biological and socialization, what about economic? I mean, wouldn't that be another factor for decisions for men or women to make choices?
Sure. Yeah.
I think absolutely. Yeah, sure. And important to say too in this analysis we looked at in the relationship quality chapter in particular, it was just looking at kind of ideology and preference. It wasn't looking at actual, you know, what was your current work pattern and what was happening. I think you're right. I think particularly when we look at this on an international scale as well. We were very sensitive to that of the realities in some of the countries that we were looking at and those patterns. So I think you're absolutely right that issues of choice are always going to be based on this idea of the economic and physical survival of the family. I think that is a great caution for us. I think sometimes in kind of academic elite circles, it's easy for us to talk as if that's kind of the commonality or the patterns, and then the reality is as we get into our
you know, Chilean or Colombian sample in this data set, we may be looking at very, very different contexts that are causing families to, both inside and outside of faith communities, to make real decisions around those fundamental physical survival aspects of a family.
You know, I'm not sure what you meant by economic, but I'm going to put my own spin on it. You know, there are very good economists like Claudia Golden and Fran Blau and so forth who've done these studies of why women have traditionally made less money than men. And after they go through everything and do this very rigorously, they find that the thing that stands out the most that can possibly explain the wage gap, other than some kind of discrimination, is the fact that women do spend more time in the home and have somewhat more discontinuous careers, less true than in the past, but still true. So this becomes then a circular thing, that, you know, women can't earn as much as men. That puts the preference on the male to do the breadwinning because he has the comparative advantage to do it. But as long as women are taking major responsibility for home and family, that's going to limit their economic prospects. So there's no way to get around that except to somehow or other just disrupt the system. One really interesting piece of research, again done by some really well-known economists, is that increasingly in married couples, we are seeing cases where the woman now earns more than the man. It's grown quite a lot. In fact, you all may not know, but you know, over 40% of families in America, the woman is the primary breadwinner, either because she's a single mom or because she's in one of these couples where she earns more than her husband. But in these couples where the woman earns more than her husband, they also do more housework. And, you know, the researchers who discovered that empirically didn't quite know what was going on there. It didn't make a lot of sense, but they hypothesized, and I think they had some circumstantial evidence, as I remember, that the reason was because the women felt guilty about the fact that they were earning more than their husbands. I mean, they were worried that that was going to, you know, undermine his sense of status, his sense of being an effective, successful breadwinner. And so they overcompensated by doing even more in the home. I can give you the citations to these studies if you're interested.
Although, just to be clear, in terms of married families with kids, it's 25% approximately of women who are earning more than their husbands. So the breadwinner story is partly driven by the fact that there
it's
are
mostly
a lot of single,
single
mothers.
It's
are,
mostly yeah. single parents, yeah. but, you know, they're
right.
here.
No, that's certainly right. Yeah, in the back.
So I have a question. My name is Val Brody. I work here at Brookings. And so my question is about a concern that I have that when we talk about evangelicals historically in the polling that I've seen in recent years, and when we seem to be talking about traditional conservative Christians, we're talking mostly about white people. And I want to understand from your survey, did you do some racial breakdown of your groups of people you interviewed, and what did those things tell you that might have been different from what they said about others?
Do you want to jump in, Spencer, here, just quickly?
So in the United States, we did include race. There are some racial differences, but they're not as pronounced as you might sort of expect.
I wouldn't expect anything.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. they are there, but they're not overly large. In the other 10 countries, one thing that's interesting about race internationally is that I think many of us have this idea that most countries are as diverse as the United States is, and that's simply not true. And so I don't even think we have race in any of those other countries except for the United States, where we did control for it. And we did see some, but not huge differences. In terms of relationship quality, they tended to follow what the existing literature says, which is that Asian Americans tend to report the highest levels of relationship quality, followed by whites, Hispanics, and then African Americans. It's important to note, however, that those differences, like many of the differences that we've been talking about today, are shrinking over time. And I think, I mean, if we extrapolate out, and again, that's a big assumption that these trends will persist exactly as is. But if they do, most of those racial differences, at least in terms of relationship quality, we can expect to disappear within the next 20 years. But again, that's a big assumption. I'm not saying that will happen, but yeah.
And then it's deeper dives for the interaction effects you're talking about of putting that inside of faith traditions. And I don't think we
although in terms of my own work looks at the impact of shared religious attendance on African Americans, Latinos, and whites in the U.S. This is a different project. It's my book called Soulmates with Nick Wolfinger. And in that particular book, what we find is that there's kind of a 10 percentage point premium for couples, black, Hispanic, and white, who attend religious services together. They're higher than their peers who either don't attend or who don't attend together. And there are modest racial differences in that book between African Americans and Hispanics and whites, but the sort of the religious gap in relationship quality is larger than the racial gap. So if that's at all helpful to your question.
Can I ask a question of the authors? You had both cohabiting and married couples in your sample. Did you break them out? I would have assumed, based on much of your past work, Brad, that you would have wanted to look at them separately and had some hypotheses about levels of commitment and relationship quality. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so we, in the interest of trying to keep the story fairly simple, we combine them and just control for marital status in this particular report. We've done some separate analyses that suggest that on average, there is more family life satisfaction and more commitment and more perceived stability on the part of married married respondents compared to cohabiting respondents in the sample. But that wasn't, you know, a key kind of sort of factor in this particular report. Mm-hmm. So.
But these differences are quite small. Like, I guess I just want to underline a lot of these differences when we talk about contemporary trends in family. These
aren't enormous differences that we're talking about. They tend to persist. They are important. But, you know, the difference in outcomes between cohabiting versus married couples are not enormous, because if they were as enormous as maybe some people think they are, we would have a much different place in the American family landscape. So yes, while these things persist, I do want to underline, our data don't suggest that they're very large, and I haven't seen much data that would suggest otherwise.
Given the stability piece, though.
Yeah, that's true. In terms of stability, you do see relatively large differences, although even that one's still large, but it is shrinking over time.
In the back.
Gabriel Greenspan from the Competitive Enterprise Institute again. I wanted to get back to this question of paid family leave, and the thought that occurs to me is that there are two types of people that could have an objection to paid family leave for both parents, and the one type that's kind of been alluded to in this panel is a sort of fundamentalist religionist. Who says, well, the man's role is to work and, therefore there shouldn't be paid family leave for both people. But the other type is, kind of someone coming from, I would say, a very American tradition of suspicion of government, limited government, who's, kind of a libertarian, who might say, yeah, it would be a great thing for both parents to be invested in the child, but, this shouldn't be something that the government is mandating on businesses, and, maybe this is something that should be done at the private sector, if businesses kind of voluntarily doing this, or NGOs or non-governmental institutions encouraging businesses to do this. And I guess, can there be a conversation about, for that type of people who might agree with the principle but not agree with the method of using government force, can there be a conversation about, maybe we can do this in a non-governmental way?
That is exactly where the debate is. There are still a lot of people, especially in the political arena, who would argue that this is not government's role, this is a family role, and if you're going to have children, you should plan for it and you should save for it, and then you're going to have private resources with which to help with the some time off needed to take care of a child. And a lot of those people also point out that the private sector already does provide quite a lot of paid leave, although not all of it, and it does, as I said earlier, tend to be very tilted towards higher paid people. So, yes, unlike other countries, the U.S. is still unable to come to any consensus about exactly that question. I mean, I might add as a footnote, sorry, that some conservatives would argue we need paid leave, but we should pay the stay-at-home mother for taking care of children just as readily as we do the woman who is in the workforce. And that gets into child credits and children's allowances.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Am I correct in thinking that your measure for religiosity, for lack of a better term, is the amount of times people attended church? Is that true? Yeah. If that's true, here comes my cynicism. A lot of people hide behind their religion, and a lot of these folks who attend church or whatever every week, and then you go to a party, and they're very proud about their religiosity. You go to a party and find, oh, he left his wife or she left her husband. And how do you account for that in a survey like this? And it's very common. I mean, I see it in my friends and my neighbors. And so,
stay tuned. I know Spencer and I have a lot of interest in this. Like I said, we do have the one sidebar. We did think about that issue. And where I think you go with this is personal worship and home religious practice. Again, not that could, you know, how much are you praying in the home? Do you have religious conversations? Do you read religious texts, right? Is this happening inside of the home, right? And again, it could be, those behaviors could be susceptible to the same thing, but I think less so than these kind of extrinsic religious social behaviors of, hey, I put myself in the pews. There's a social piece to that. It does, and we had a lot of conversation about should we build the religiosity index. We decided to go with the sidebar that looks at the patterns of prayer in the home, and it shows it to be a positive factor. I think it's a dosage issue, and I think it is trying to get to these subgroups. I think you'd get a smaller, so back to the question we've had, you may have bigger impact, but is it with a smaller segment of society? Right, but you would find that that subset of couples where it is more than just the extrinsic religious attendance, but it is also the intrinsic personal worship. We also have some questions that get into people's sense of spirituality, their sense of presence of God in their lives, these types of things. So I think you're right. I think there can be even further. My sense is what we'd see is that group being even stronger in some of the effects that we've identified. But it would be a smaller segment of society that would get into that truly kind of personal orthodoxy pattern that hopefully would bring more consistency that you're talking about, not just kind of a here's my religiosity on a day of worship, but I'm different at other times.
But I think that another point I would make too is that number one, or I guess three, number one, religion is not a panacea, certainly in our view, and secondly, that there are certainly religious hypocrites, including myself, and different outcomes, as there are with across any number of different ideological groupings, in American life. And then the third piece is there is kind of a classic difference in the literature between intrinsic religiosity and extrinsic religiosity. So people who are kind of doing religious things to sort of send off social signals often have things going on in the background that aren't so good, whereas folks who are trying to kind of as best they can be living in accord with their tradition, kind of at the sort of individual level, sort of away from the
you know, the spotlight, tend to do better on a lot of these outcomes. But we're basically, you know, at the end of our time, you know, I just want to give each panelist a quick opportunity to say anything else that comes to mind. So I'll just start with Han on the left, and nope, you're good.
No, Belle, I'm very happy. This was really interesting. Thank you.
I just want to say that this was a very interesting discussion, and you all did some very interesting work. Yeah. So thank you for doing all of that.
Great.
Oh, just a thank you to the panelists and others who've come in. It's always great to get this kind of discussion and have this kind of feedback and dialogue. So thank you to all of you who've taken time to prepare and to be with us on the panel today.
Great. So thanks, everyone, for coming. Appreciate it.